Hello, hello, hello. Welcome and thank you for lending your ears, Ridiculous Historians. I'd like to begin today's episode with an excellent trivia question. I think this will work. Noel, you're a fan of trivia.
I'm a huge fan of trivia. Hit me, Ben.
All right. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've been in your Noel. I forget that part sometimes.
We accomplished it.
Yeah. So here's the trivia. Which U.S. states were once upon a time independent countries of their own?
Countries, you say?
Well, countries, there's the Kingdom of Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
There's the California Republic.
Ah.
There's Texas as well.
Yep, yep.
Which is still very proud of that period in their history.
I mean, they're trying to turn back the clock, in fact.
Yeah, and there's one that might surprise many people, and that is Vermont.
Vermont, you say? Home of Ben and Jerry's.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders.
Fish.
Trees.
Right, I think Fish is from Vermont.
The band Fish.
The band Fish.
I thought we were just now naming things.
Yeah, yeah, Fish. Jimmy Jam noodly guitar guys. Apparently they got together at the University of Vermont in Burlington.
I could see that meeting, Noel. Maybe they said, you know what I hate? When songs are less than 20 minutes long.
No, man. Yeah. It's funny, too, because, like, the people that are really into that band are like, dude, did you hear that one show? They played, like, the longest ever version of Slippy Dip.
Yeah.
That's a Fish song I just made up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's up there with Pom Quat.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think it's off there. That's a concept album.
Yep.
Only real music heads will get that reference.
Fish heads.
Yeah, only real fish heads. Real music aficionados like our man on the ones and twos, ladies and gentlemen, super producer Casey Pegram. Noel, have you ever been to Vermont?
No, but it seems glorious, and it's beautiful. It's very green,
mm-hmm.
And it just seems kind of like a bit of a liberal paradise.
You know, it's often portrayed that way. It's also very popular with nature lovers, as long as you don't mind a little cold.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and one other fun trivia fact that, I don't know, will either fascinate you in a weird way the way it did me or just seem completely irrelevant unless you're playing a game of trivia is the following. Of all the U.S. state capitals, the capital of Vermont, Montpelier, is the only one in the nation to not have a McDonald's.
Oh, I think you mean Montpelier. Casey?
Montpelier.
Ah.
And that is Casey on the case.
Crushing me.
Well, the interesting thing here is that for most of us in the modern day, whether in the U.S. or abroad, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people outside of the U.S. haven't really heard much about Vermont. It's not one of those states like New York or California that seems to be in the news every single day.
No, no, it's definitely not, because it feels like there's sort of a little enclave, a little island in the stream, sort of an oasis, right?
Yeah.
Because not only does Montpelier,
Not bad.
Okay. Ha, Casey on the case. Not have a McDonald's. In fact, in all of Vermont, billboards, my friend?
Yeah.
You're not going to find a one unless they're hand-painted, because they are outlawed. They are verboten.
Hand-painted and I think showing the way to downtown or something like that? It's pretty specific.
But we're not here to just list off trivia, facts about Vermont, which you can find at 50states.com/facts/vermont.htm, by the way, if you want to, you know, read some more of these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead, we are here to explore the story of Vermont's history, or as some people called it once upon a time, New Connecticut.
New Connecticut.
New Connecticut.
I like Vermont better.
I like Vermont, too. I'm a little... I don't know. Every time I read something about a region or a state named New something, I always think, surely there was, out of all the sounds a human mouth can make, surely you could have made something that wasn't new.
Totally.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's like, you know, when you have a Chinese restaurant where it's like Minghua 2 or like yeah. new Minghua.
Right, right.
That's just, come on.
Or we're both pretty big Mitchell and Webb look fans, also Peep Show.
Yeah.
They've got this great running sketch that addresses how, at least in their opinion, how newly colonized places acquired these strange names. Like New South Wales, it's a pretty weird name for Australia, you know? Or the Australian territory.
Well, and I'm confused because we're going to talk about, you know, before people shred us apart for not getting to the damn point, we are going to talk about the history of Vermont and where it came from, but I am confused about Connecticut because Vermont's not even not near Connecticut.
Well, yeah, no, it's the new Connecticut.
It's
like new Coke.
It's confusing.
I'm just messing with you.
I know, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
Back in the day, in the olden days, just before the American Revolution, in fact, when we were still colonies of Mother England, there were land grants given out, or the privilege of granting settlers parcels of land.
Yeah.
And those were at the behest of the rulers, I guess, or was there maybe there's a the baron, I don't know, of established colonies.
Right, the colonial governing structure.
Boom, there you go. New York being one of them.
And New Hampshire being another.
So there was this thing called the New Hampshire land grants. And of that, what became modern-day Vermont was included. But there was a problem, Ben. Because it was like New York was giving out land willy-nilly.
Yep.
And New Hampshire was giving out land willy-nilly.
And they were giving out the same land. They were double booking. So
crossover.
Yeah. So let's say you want to settle in what would later become known as Vermont. And you go to the designated place that you have been granted, right? And you find that there's already someone living there. And they think, well, hey, buddy.
What gives?
What's your beef? You know, why are you beefing up with me? I also have this land grant. And they go, well, I have one from New York. Well, I have one from New Hampshire. Not a good look.
No. And then what, do they just duke it out?
Right.
I mean,
right,
come on.
Right.
This is a recipe for chaos, my friend.
So what happens next?
Oh, well, can we talk about the Green Mountain Boys?
I would love to talk about the Green Mountain Boys and Ethan Allen, their leader.
Yeah, not to be confused with the furniture proprietaire.
Right.
It is the same. Is it the same?
We'll have to find out. I don't buy a lot of Ethan Allen furniture.
All my furniture is from IKEA.
Yes, that's the correct pronunciation. So the Green Mountain Boys were a militia that was first established in the 1760s in the territory between New York and New Hampshire.
They were an unofficial militia, too, or an unsanctioned militia.
Yeah.
Which I kind of always, when I hear the word militia, I always kind of think it's people deciding we're going to, you know, join forces and become a little mini army.
Right.
Never seems like they're particularly sanctioned, but I guess that's not true.
That's not true in every case. It's just in the U.S. nowadays, usually when we hear the term militia, we think of separatist forces in the U.S., right?
There you go.
So at this time, as the Revolutionary War is kicking into full steam, it's all hands on deck. If you want to fight the British, the colonial powers are not going to say no to you. And the Green Mountain Boys make a name for themselves during the war.
They do. I mean, their primary goal was to defend these folks who received land grants from New Hampshire against the ones that got them from New York, who they referred to as the Yorkies or the Yorkers. I think it's Yorkies. That sounds a little more like a term of abuse. I'm going with Yorkies. Come at me, Internet.
Let's go with Yorkies because Yorkers, you know, it sounds like the term for the people from York. We're talking about New York.
Exactly. But that was their thing.
So the Green Mountain Boys formed, as you said, Noel, to protect people with New Hampshire grants, they also performed pretty well in the Revolutionary War, most notably when they captured Fort Ticonderoga on May 10th of 1775. And then later, also, they invaded Canada technically, or more specifically, they briefly held St. John's in Quebec, but then when they heard that British military was coming, they dipped. And they later became, oh, you know what? I've got to interrupt. Casey is going to kill us if we don't mention the etymology of Green Mountain.
Oh, it's true. Well, there's a couple things here.
Yeah.
The Green Mountain Boys took their name because they were protecting folks who had these disputed land grants.
Right.
They received it from New Hampshire, but New York said that New Hampshire had no rights to lands west of the Green Mountains.
And so the Green Mountain Boys.
The Green Mountain Boys.
And also Vermont itself is a mispronunciation or mistranslation of a French word. And I propose that we consult our own francophone. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Casey on the case.
I concur.
Yeah, so Vermont would be from the French vert for green and mont for mountain, so Vermont. But the syntax is kind of done in the English style. In French, you would say mont vert, whereas in English, we put the adjective before the noun, so Vermont.
Ladies and gentlemen, Casey on the case.
I'm so glad he's here.
He's the best.
So
we're going to miss him.
Oh, that's right. Should we announce?
I guess we should.
Well, let's announce our close friend, one of the best parts of this show, Casey Pegram, will be embarking on a grand adventure very soon. He will return, but we're going to miss him.
Yeah, but we've kind of twisted his arm off mic in the hopes that he will send us some sweet audio postcards from France.
Mm-hmm. That's right. He is traveling back to France for a while.
So the Green Mountain Boys, they were kind of terrorists in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
At least in so much as they terrorized these settlers who had the grants of land from New York. Mm-hmm. They apparently, would cattle rustle, and they even were known for beating the crap out of people with birch rods.
Yeah, and it goes back to this idea of them being kind of, I don't want to say knuckleheads, but very much acting in their own interests rather than some greater ideology of what we would call the United States. And in 1777, they established their independence, but they didn't partner up with New York. They didn't partner up with New Hampshire. No, sir. They became their own republic with their own currency, their own flag. And the Green Mountain Boys, which were still active, became just one of a number of what we would call irregulars, because Vermont initially supported the Revolutionary War. They fought against Quebec, but in 1777, they got more of a neutral stance, and deserters from the colonial armies, as well as the British armies, would go to Vermont. And George Washington was asked by Congress to go in and subdue Vermont, take possession of it.
It seemed pretty subdued to me already.
Yeah. Around the same time, some members of the Green Mountain Boys, not all of them, started having secret talks with British officials in Quebec to say, hey, do you want to take over?
Let's boo up. Yeah, but that didn't work out because Quebec wanted to see how this whole revolution thing was going to shake out.
That's right. And, we could argue that fortunately for us as a nation, Vermont stayed a part of the United States, but not yet, because it's 1777, so they're still independent for a few years.
They had their own constitution, even.
Yeah, adopted off the one Benjamin Franklin wrote for Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
And this constitution was very progressive for its time and forward-facing. It had some guarantees that the rest of the United States had not legislated.
Yeah, and now when we talk about this, this seems like duh, but that all men, could vote even if they weren't property owners, and they also were very progressive in that they outlawed adult slavery, and I always see that. Does that mean child slavery was still okay?
Right. Yeah, that's a troubling caveat. But still, they were outlawing slavery some form.
That's more than we can say for the rest of the country.
That is true. When they were voting on this constitution, it was described as a baptism of thunder, lightning, and rain because the weather was really bad, and they got stuck inside. And let's talk about a few of the things they did once they became an independent republic. We said they had their own flag.
That's right.
What else did they have?
They also had their own currency, which was called Vermont coppers. Sounds very British to me.
Mm-hmm. They were made, of course, in Vermont. Vermont also operated a postal system.
That's right.
Grew their own food. They had their own roads. They were ready to go it alone. But they were still in conflict with New York.
Yeah, oh, big time. Because, New York was pretty sore about them having just kind of bogarted those land grants that they felt like they had the rights to, and those pesky Green Mountain boys whipping their folks with their birch rods, that wasn't going to fly.
Right, yeah. And eventually, it comes down to a matter of negotiations, right? Mm-hmm. So for around 14 years, Vermont is this tremendous anomaly in the northeastern part of what would later become known as the United States. And they were still in conflict with New York in an unsustainable situation. But things began to get back on the rails, back on track in March of 1790 when New York and Vermont cracked a deal.
Well, this is when the revolution had come to an end, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And territories or colonies were being made into states.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because of the contentious nature of their relationship during the Wild West period that was the Revolutionary War, New York and Vermont had to come to terms before New York would consent to Vermont being made a state. Not that it was entirely up to them, but they certainly were making a stink about it, right? Ben, tell me, give me the deets here.
So it's that same boundary dispute that was dogging them for so long. The fact that the Green Mountain Boys were operating as a de facto government meant that they were also part of the negotiation process here. And so New York and Vermont got together. They had a group of people representing the New York side of the argument, a group representing the Vermont side, and they said, we are going to negotiate the boundary. We need to know where New York stops and Vermont begins. The folks negotiating on Vermont's side said, we also have to settle these real estate disputes. We cannot leave those to be decided by a larger court.
Mm-mm.
Let's one-on-one figure this out.
That seems smart.
I think
seems
so
equitable.
Too. Yeah, because there's so many more variables that could happen if it goes into a federal court. Right?
What a nasty situation. I mean, it seems like the New Hampshire grant recipients having these rabble-rousing Green Mountain Boys on their side certainly helped them out during the time. But think about it from New York's perspective. I mean, what did they do wrong? They have the same claim as New Hampshire did as far as they were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they probably felt a little rightfully sore about the whole situation. Physically sore on their bottoms from being hit with switches.
And fiscally sore on their bank accounts or their purses or, you know, their sacks of coppers.
Sure.
So they eventually, thank goodness, crack a deal. And on October 7th of 1790, they announce as a group that the negotiations are done and it's a success. And the bottom line is that the Green Mountain people are going to be able to keep the land grants that were issued, the land that was issued to them via New Hampshire, and the New Yorkers are not going to get these New York patents.
The Yorkies?
The Yorkies mm-hmm. are not receiving this. Instead, Vermont is going to pay $30,000 to New York, $30,000 in 1790, we'll inflate in a second, and this will be distributed amidst the Yorkies, New York residents, who, you know, rightfully feel like they got their land stolen. And $30,000 in 1790 is a big number, but it's not as surprising as I would have assumed. $30,000 in 1790 is $790,000 approximately in 2018.
Okay. Not that impressive.
Not that impressive.
Seems like a pretty good deal, to be honest.
Honestly, it does, because that's an entire state. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
That's a great deal. You can't go buy a state for $1 million today, just a district.
Yeah.
And so eventually Vermont is admitted to the Union in 1791. It's interesting because it's the only state admitted without conditions of any kind, either those prescribed by Congress or the state from which it was carved.
Other than the 30K.
Other than that 30 large, yeah. That 30, was 30 hooligans, 30,000 hooligans.
Or 30,000 biscuits.
Yes, yes, or Jeb Jams or Pony Bones. What are we talking about? We'll get to it in a second. But for now, it's important to note that part of the reason Vermont was accepted into the Union was to be a free state counterweight to the slave state, Kentucky.
Oof.
Oof, indeed. So this would appear to be the short-lived tale of Vermont's career as an independent republic.
But wait.
he said.
There's more.
Right, right. You see, many philosophers will tell you that time itself is a series of wheels. And in our modern day, folks, it seems that the wheel has turned again.
In around 2003, a movement became afoot.
Yes, yes, that is correct, Noel. Professor Emeritus of Economics at Duke University, a fellow named Thomas H. Naylor, founded the Second Vermont Republic movement, and he argued that the U.S. has become an ungovernable empire, much like the former Soviet Union. And Naylor's description of the Second Vermont Republic is a nonviolent citizens network and think tank opposed to the tyranny of corporate America and the U.S. government and committed to the return of Vermont to its status as an independent republic as it had been between 1777 and 1791. He calls himself, Naylor describes himself, as a left-leaning libertarian with strong anarchist tendencies.
Okay. There you have it.
Not pulling many punches.
No, none punches. And in fact, this movement has a manifesto. And in the manifesto, they quote Thomas Jefferson himself. And it's really hard to argue with this, the words of the founding father. Quote, "Whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." And here's the thing. They have a list of demands
yes.
in this manifesto that they want to achieve. Shall we go through them, Ben?
Sure.
First, we find it increasingly difficult to protect ourselves from the debilitating effects of big government, big business, big markets, and big agriculture, who want all of us to be the same and to love bigness as much as they do.
Second, in addition to being too big, our government is too centralized, too powerful, too intrusive, too materialistic, and too unresponsive to the needs of individual citizens and small communities.
Third, the U.S. government has lost its moral authority because it is owned, operated, and controlled by corporate America. National and congressional elections are bought and sold to the highest bidders.
Fourth, we have a single political party, the Republican Party, disguised as a two-party system. The Democratic Party is effectively brain dead, having no new ideas since the 1960s.
Is that a Vermont accent?
No, I want it to sound like a bunch of people reading it.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm going to be the one kind of angry, samey guy. Fifth, we have become disillusioned with the so-called American way, corporate greed, the war on terrorism, homeland security, the denial of civil liberties, pandering to the rich and powerful, environmental insensitivity, and the culture of deceit.
Sixth, American foreign policy, which is based on the doctrine of full-spectrum dominance, is immoral, illegal, unconstitutional, and in violation of the United Nations Charter.
I was like an old man there.
Yeah.
Seventh, as long as Vermont remains in the Union, we face the risk of terrorist attack and military conscription of our youth.
Eight, the U.S. suffers from imperial overstretch and has become unsustainable politically, economically, agriculturally, socially, culturally, and environmentally. It has become both ungovernable and unfixable.
And that's where we get to the Jefferson quote. All of this stuff is in response to the actual Constitution of the United States giving us an out in the event that these things, you know, come to pass, as the founders of this movement seem to think they have.
And you can find information about this on multiple websites by several different authors, and they will make numerous arguments about, I guess, Vermont's capacity to be independent,
sure.
like to grow its own food, monitor its population. And a lot of the arguments that you'll see extended here are very progressive, considering what the rest of the U.S. is doing.
Oh, big time. And, you know, there was a sense that this movement kind of faded a little bit from the public eye and from any, you know, semblance of ever possibly coming to fruition. But with our current president, who, you know, many folks of this kind of left-leaning ideology have some real serious beef with, there's a sense that who knows, you know, maybe this could happen because in an article from 7 Days, Vermont's Independent Voice, entitled "If at First You Don't Secede, Trump Could Revitalize Vermont Movement," there's a lot of discussion around the kind of resurgence of this movement.
Yeah, absolutely. They mentioned the Vermont Manifesto that we've talked about. They have an argument of unsustainability, right, on the part of what they would call the American empire. It's too large. It's too damaging to the people who are governed by this. And a lot of their claims, one of the claims that really stuck out to me in this one is they talked a little bit about framing it. They said, you know, if you don't call it secession, if you don't call it separatism, if you don't call it secession and focus instead on values, 90% of Vermonters will support you. And so the idea there is that the residents of Vermont already feel that they are kind of separate.
What does it take, Ben, to secede?
Oof. Oof. It's a rough one because, you know, at numerous times, especially in, you know, in the formation of the country and sometimes in recent years, various groups of people have decided that they are a sovereign state. There was one here in Georgia a number of years ago called the Sovereign State of Georgia. They were more in the South, I believe.
Very, very creative.
Very creative. Burst of creativity. They had their own licenses. They had their own license plates and stuff, and they were making their own currency. And they, like several other separatist groups, believed that they could become a sovereign nation just by claiming it and putting a sign up. So that they would have signs. If law enforcement officials came to their area, there would be a sign that was like, this is not U.S. property. This is the sovereign state of Georgia.
That foreign seems misinformed.
It's a little misinformed. No foreign powers are allowed on this. Spoiler alert, it never stopped the cops or the FBI or anything.
Because that's what would happen, right? What would happen? Like if we decided, you know, with the support of our entire state here in Georgia, that we were going to secede and we managed to that would require us establishing militias, I imagine, right?
Yeah.
And becoming completely self-sustaining and independent, where we could be cut off entirely from any government assistance or any aid from the federal government.
Yeah, here's why it's tricky. Right now, the U.S. Supreme Court considers what they call unilateral secession unconstitutional.
Ooh.
So if everybody in Vermont just by themselves, only the state of Vermont decided, hey, we're not part of this crazy continental house party.
Get me off this crazy thing. That was great. George Jetson.
Yeah. Called Love. That was So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Also good.
That was pretty good. It was surprisingly good. Not my impression, but the film. Anyway, because of a case called Texas versus White, the Supreme Court says that states can't secede on their own. However, if they get the agreement of other states constitutionally, it could be possible. Like if one state wants to secede, if Oklahoma for some reason says we've had it, even though we're surrounded by other states, we want to do our own thing, and the other 49 states are all like, totally, man. It's just been weird for a while, and we're
ready for a change.
We could still be friends. Then it could be possible if all the states agree. That's never going to happen.
Unlikely.
That is highly unlikely.
It would have to be like a perfect storm of things falling in place. Like, I don't know. I don't. There's really no mechanism to do it other than like pure revolt, right? Isn't that kind of what it would be considered, being an open revolt?
Right, it would be. And if it were, again, unilateral. But that's the case for a reason, because countries or groups of states don't typically bake in that kind of secession. A lot of people also say that the second Vermont movement, Vermont independence movement, has been empowered by Brexit, the process through which the UK is leaving the European Union. And
that was a parliamentary procedure. I mean, that was an official vote, part of their democracy.
Right. Yeah, that was. And that's something that EU member states can do if they want. But now they have a portmanteau for the second Vermont thing that is not super groundbreaking, but I love it because it's fun to say. Vexit.
I was going to say Vermexit.
Vermexit. That sounds like a pesticide.
I'm into it.
Vermexit. But I wanted to ask you, you know, do you think that this is a good idea? Do you think it's likely? Think it could happen?
It seems a little self-defeating to me. I don't know. Are there any Vermonters out there that are down with this cause, that know a little bit more, like, on-the-ground info about the plan here? I'm interested, because I really don't understand how it would functionally happen.
And I see where they're coming from with a lot of the arguments. You know, they have problems with overarching corporate governance.
I hear that.
Right? You know, it's not like they're making some crazy claim like we are going to be an independent state with no Welsh residents or something.
No. It's weird because it's like they want to be separate, but it's all about inclusion. Mm. It's weird. It's not like we're saying get out. It's saying we don't want to come in.
Yeah. It's a sticky situation, but I think that you found the perfect way for us to end, or the perfect question for us to end this on. If you are from Vermont, if you are familiar with the place, let us know about your experience and let us know if you support this, because as we have often said, you are the most important part of the show. We want to hear about you, and we're putting our money where our mic is, I guess. We should do listener mail.
I think we should. All right, our first listener mail. This is sort of a heavy one. We got an email, two emails about the episode we did on banned books, banned science books.
Yep.
One of them, the subject was Noel, I Was Bummed. And here's how it goes. Hi, gentlemen. First of all, a huge fan of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and Ridiculous History. I had a whole spiel in mind to counterpoint your dismissal of fruitcake, but I was in the middle of a long walk. I homeschool a reluctant and anxious 12-year-old and play your podcast in the car to keep the learning going strong.
That's awesome.
It's very cool. And I just thought this was the most thoughtful, sweet, intelligent email that we've gotten in a minute. But I was bummed to see that it was about a feeling of being disrespected, and that is never what we want to do on this show. So I'm just going to give you the broad strokes here. I just listened to Three Times Society Refused to Accept Banned Books, and Noel, I'm such a fan of your whole personality and Ben's and Matt's great things happening, but I was disappointed in the way you handled some things on that episode. I'm paraphrasing just a little bit. She goes, perhaps it's wishful thinking, but I submit that scorning people who hold their deep and personal faith a notch above the theory of evolution is becoming outmoded. When I lived on a street with several Hindu families last year, they had days set aside for sweeping the demons out of their homes right into the street, I must assume, and they kept images of terrifying faces over their front doors. This was the Dallas suburbs, USA, where we are free to practice our faith in hopefully a respectful environment. I know I respected my Hindu neighbors, though our beliefs differed. I'm a human being who deeply believes in God, loves my family, writes useless pop songs, drinks whiskey, smokes when angry, and embroiders nonsense, teaches my child at home with such resources as Candy Freak by Steve Almond, your wonderful podcast, and yes, the Bible. I married my husband in part for his vast record collection. Evolution? I don't know for sure, nor do I sweat it. God can do anything he wants, including making cryptids just to hide them for fun. It's a big world out there, don't forget. No need to assume everyone listening is just like you, and faith is so personal and so dear to people. Stay away from scorn and dismissiveness. They, unlike the decision not to worship evolution, are for the young and uninformed. I love you too much. Amy Z. So this specifically mentioning something that I said, and I feel like I took a bit of a tone in that episode that I regret. I don't step back from my opinion, but I realize that it does seem like maybe it came across as I was criticizing Christianity, and I think the reason that I may have taken that tone is because I grew up Christian, and my relationship with Christianity is complicated, just like everyone's relationship with their faith can be complicated. And I think there's a sense of it being on my turf and in my personal worldview, so maybe I felt a little quicker to get snarky about it. And I also didn't mean to equate directly the idea of not believing in evolution with being somehow ignorant or uninformed.
You know, there was I remember distinctly there was a moment in that podcast where we talked about some Anglican individuals and organizations who did not feel that what Charles Darwin was writing about was contradictory or insulting to their faith. And one thing that you and I have always taken pains with, not just on this show, but any show in our House of Works network, one thing you and I have always taken pains to do is to, you know, mention that faith is an intensely personal thing, and it's very important to us as a unit not to tell you what to believe if it comes to, you know, your spiritual values.
Absolutely. It's something that we hold very dear and personally important to be as inclusive as possible when it comes to all faiths. And I think in this particular situation, my tone sort of betrayed my intention because of that complicated relationship I have with the Christian faith.
In like your own personal life.
In my own personal life. I mean, I grew up in the Methodist church and was surrounded by people who I think I felt were a little bit judgmental and were not willing to see both sides of an argument and maybe were too willing to take everything in the Bible at face value rather than seeing some things in the Bible as an allegory or some kind of descriptive story to help understand things like epics and time. And I don't know. How do you see it, Ben?
Well, I think first off, as longtime listeners know, you and I are old friends outside of work too. Mm. And I can assure everyone listening that you're not Noel Brown is not a mean person, nor the type to you're not a guy who mocks things that are, you know, I don't think you ever come from a mean-spirited place at all. And additionally, you know, we just have to return to the same point. We fundamentally do not believe in, nor do we practice telling people what spiritual paths they should take. They are your own.
Here's the thing too, and then we'll leave it. The nature of this show, obviously it's a conversation between Ben, you, and me, but it's also a conversation with the audience that they are not able to directly participate in at the moment. Even though my favorite podcast, I feel like I'm part of the conversation and I'm listening to people have a conversation that I am kind of vicariously experiencing. If I were to hang out with Amy Z and have this conversation and express my opinions on evolution as they pertain to faith, etc., there would be a dialogue going on as opposed to, I think, an interpretation that I was being intentionally condescending where I think in a real conversation over dinner or drinks, that would be clearly not you would see that that was not the case.
Yeah, that's a great point. Also, Amy, thank you so very much for writing.
This is a
beautifully written letter. And don't know if you still live in Dallas, but if you do, say hey to the town for me. I've got some folks who live in Dallas. Librarians. A lot of librarians in my family, Noel.
I did not know that about you, Ben.
Well, yeah, it's a true story. We do have one more letter that made us laugh out loud, and I feel like we have to read this one because we totally did an inside joke with ourselves about it earlier in the episode.
It was a little sneak peek.
So here we go. Trey H. writes in with an email entitled Other Terms for Money. Hey, dude, says Trey, longtime listener of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and relatively new listener of Ridiculous History. I'm loving the podcast. Keep it up. He sent us a thumbs up emoji, so you know it's legit. Anyway, I just wanted to talk to you about your episode, What's the Deal with $2 Bills? You guys mentioned something along the lines of how you can almost replace the words money or dollars with just about anything, and people will probably still know what you're talking about. I found that hilarious and decided to try it out on some of my friends. Long story short, I'm buying some old records from a buddy of mine for $40. So during our conversation over Snapchat, I tried this out twice. I referred to the $40 as 40 biscuits and 40 hooligans, and in both cases, my friend just rolled with it the same as any other normal conversation we would have. I'll probably continue this and try it out on other people as well because it's a lot of fun. I'll email you again if I get any funny instances. Once again, thank you. Keep up the good work on the podcast.
You know, pony bones.
Yeah, Jim Jams, biscuits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would love to hear more of these. I think that we should start. I mean, I've already started. I'll confess to you, I've already started doing this in daily life.
Do you have a running list?
I have some that worked. The one of the weirdest ones I pulled off this week was Pepadews.
That's amazing.
People will just agree with it.
Yeah, I'm into
it. I heard Casey.
It was an audible laugh from outside the sweat box.
And we have encountered numerous instances of this. So we wanted to say thank you, Trey, for writing to us. And hopefully you're inspiring your fellow listeners to find some more, to see how far you can push it. You know, I think shorter words are probably better. Noel, I don't think either of us could get away with a sentence-length slang.
No, but something like scallywag might be cool.
There we go. Yeah.
But definitely not, hey, man, where's my 5 pneumono-ultra microscopic silico-volcanic coniosises?
Yeah. They would say, is that a medical condition or something like that?
It is. It's a black lung disease.
Is that really? Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah, I learned that. That's something that's the one thing that stuck with me from middle school.
Well done. So we are going to call it a day. We want to thank you very, very much, Amy. Thank you, Trey, as well. Thanks to everybody who's been writing in and finding us on Instagram, on Facebook, via our email, ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. The other things we do.
Yeah.
Help me out here.
Yeah. Yeah, still workshopping away at that Pinterest board. But we do have an active Facebook group called The Ridiculous Historians you can be a part of. It's really become a fun little community. We pop in there and, you know, post embarrassing pictures and videos of ourselves for your amusement, you sickos.
Right. And we encourage you to participate in some of the wonderful threads your fellow listeners have started.
I'm sorry I called you sickos. I think you're lovely people.
Time continues on. Who knows? By the time someone's listening to this a few years from now, sickos may be like a tremendous compliment.
Yeah, it also makes fools of us all. Time.
Time. Yeah. Time after time.
It's also never time at all.
Yes, but it is time for us to end the show. We hope that you have enjoyed this look at the strange story of Vermont, and we hope you stay tuned for our next episode examining some rituals from ancient Mayan culture.
Rituals, you say? Are you referring to ritual alcohol enemas, my friend?
Yeah. Yep. Actually, we're not joking.
We're going to give that a whole episode?
We're going to do something with it.
Good Lord. I can't wait.
I'm interested to see how it works out, too. But do tune in, see if we can pull that one off.
Remember butt chugging?
I read something about butt chugging recently.
Yeah, there was a frat, a whole kerfuffle where these frat guys were doing a thing called butt chugging where they kind of give themselves their own ritual alcohol enemas.
Right, like they, yeah.
Yeah, the name says it all. And apparently it gets you quite tipsy.
So join us for what is sure to be the classiest episode of Ridiculous History in our career.
Classier than the LBJ episode?
Even classier than LBJ, if you can believe it or not. We'd like to thank Casey Pegram, of course. Mm-hmm. Bid him bon voyage as he is preparing to leave on his trip or on his adventure.
Yes.
I dare say. And we'd also like to thank, of course, Alex Williams.
And Christopher Hasiotis, our researcher extraordinaire. And, of course, we'd like to thank you, folks.
Yes, thank you so much, Vermonters and non-Vermonters alike.
Sure, yeah. And we hope that we'll see you again very soon on another episode of Ridiculous History. Goodbye.